From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Bats get a bad rap, but they play a pivotal role in nature. They devour insects, and their furry bodies can spread pollen. Bats make up one-fourth of all mammal species. Ecologist Daniel Feller tells us about the devastation caused by the fungal disease white nose syndrome, which has killed millions of bats in North America. How is this disease spread? And Kirsten Bone, researcher at Johns Hopkins Bat Communication Lab, decodes the sounds bats make.
The beginning, when you just hear a tick, 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 that is the echolocation pulses. They're very short, and then there's a gap. And during that gap after them is when they get the returning echo, which they use to see, and they need to get that returning echo before they produce another one.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. This morning we're talking all about bats. Bats get a bad rap as bloodsuckers and disease carriers, but bats play an important role in our environment, eating insects and helping carry pollen via their furry bodies. Later we'll speak with a researcher who decodes what bats are saying, from the sounds they use to echolocate to the songs they sing to attract mates. But first, a disease that is decimating the bat population. White nose syndrome has spread to 31 states and 5 Canadian provinces. It has killed millions of bats. How will this affect our ecosystem? And can the bat population recover? Daniel Feller, an ecologist with the Wildlife and Heritage Service of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, is with us from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, Appalachian Laboratory in Frostburg. Welcome to On the Record, Dan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So there are bats that live in Maryland year-round and hibernate during the winter, and bats that migrate to Maryland during the summer. Which bats does white nose syndrome affect?
White nose syndrome is affecting our cave hibernating bats. 6 of the 10 species that occur in Maryland are affected by white nose syndrome.
And what are the symptoms of white nose syndrome?
Initially, when white nose syndrome hit Maryland in 2010, we saw bats in hibernacula that had a strange white filamentous fungi growing out of their muzzles and off their forearms or any exposed skin. And this fungus actually caused some behavioral changes in the bats where they were awakened out of their hibernating sleep called torpor. And a lot of times the bats move to the front of the cave near the entrance, which is an unusual place for a lot of bat species. Some bats even left the cave hibernacula in midwinter and were flying out on the landscape, sometimes in snow-covered areas. And most of those bats ended up dying.
Does white nose syndrome affect all bats equally?
No, it doesn't. Of the 6 hibernating species that we have, 3 were affected most dramatically. And strangely enough, those are the 3 of the most common species that occur throughout Maryland previously. The little brown bat, the tricolor bat, and the northern long-eared bat have seen declines in Maryland of 90% to 99%, depending on the species. A couple of other cave hibernating bats were also affected. Initially, we saw some mortality, but even one species seems to be rebounding a little bit. Those other 3 species are still heavily declined from what their previous levels were.
Okay, I need to backtrack. How do you know what the basic bat population was to judge how many bats have been lost?
We've been fortunate in Maryland. We've had, there were some really early surveys in the 1960s, here and there by Fish and Wildlife Service personnel and others. But there was a comprehensive study done in the late 70s, early 80s by Dr. Edward Gates at the Appalachian Laboratory, and many students and faculty research assistants that worked with him. And they did the early documentation of bats, on the, mostly in hibernacula, but also some landscape work. But just for a few years, we have data from, like I said, the late 70s, early 80s. And then I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to do additional sampling beginning around 1990, and mostly in hibernacula.
Let me interrupt and ask, hibernacula basically means caves?
Yeah, so it's largely natural caves, but it also includes abandoned mines and abandoned railroad tunnels. And some of those are significant places for bats to overwinter in.
So when you say that you did research in hibernacula, in caves, mines, tunnels, you walked into these places and counted bats, or what did you do?
I did. I had done research on cave invertebrates, little crustacea and spiders and beetles that are blind and unpigmented that live in those deep, dark denizens under the earth. And while I was in there, I noted all the bats that were in there, and I was able to get federal funding to start monitoring those populations around 1990. And I've done so every year pretty much since then. So we had a really good data set in Maryland, and that's been bolstered by additional funding that we got from state capacity grants from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in cooperation with Dr. Edward Gates and his research crew. We've done harp trapping. We catch the bats at cave entrances, but we also have done acoustic monitoring where we mount a microphone on top of a car and we run a designated 20-mile route across 18 areas across the state. So we have a good amount of data before white nose syndrome hit and now afterwards. So we're able to compare those numbers and really have really good idea of how these species have declined.
That's Daniel Feller, an ecologist for the Wildlife and Heritage Service at the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. Here on The Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about white nose syndrome, a disease that has devastated the bat population in North America. And I gather part of the impact of white nose syndrome is that bats cannot reproduce as fast as the disease is killing them off.
Well, that's true. As far as we know, you know, we're still understanding the repercussions of the disease on bats. You know, bats have very low reproductive rates. It takes several years for them to become mature, to be able to reproduce. And then many species have only one or two pups per year. So the recovery rate is very, very slow, and the mortality rate's been very, very high. And we're actually concerned about some of these species becoming extinct. One of those species, the northern long-eared bat, which was common in Maryland, has now been listed as federally threatened and, of course, is listed as threatened in Maryland as well. In all my hibernacula surveys this year, I hit 15 caves, tunnels, and mines. I didn't see a single individual of that species, so we're really concerned.
What is the normal lifespan of a bat if it's not interrupted by disease?
Bats can live as long as 20 years or maybe even more.
So what are the theories about how white nose syndrome is spread?
There have been a lot of epidemiology studies done, and you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service has funded research by other federal agencies, state agencies, and universities across the country trying to figure this out. I mean, this species was just described, this fungus that causes it. We call it PD for short. It's really Pseudogymnoascus destructans, wild a name. We just discovered this. So we're really in the mode where we're learning about the fungus, about where it can grow and how fast it grows and how it affects the bats. And we're trying to determine, you know, how that's going to affect these species' persistence in time.
And do we know whether bats spread it to each other or whether they pick it up?
They do. So we do know that they transmit it from bat to bat, but we also know that the spores are in the cave or hibernacula environment, and that even caves that no longer have bats are still infective, that when bats are reintroduced to those sites, they still get the disease and die. So it looks like the fungus isn't going away even if bats die.
And is it only here in North America?
Well, that's the interesting thing. There's been some this the fungus was described from North America because it causes this mass mortality in bats. So it brought our attention to it. But when we started looking closely and word got out, our counterpart biologist in Europe said, well, we have fungus like that that grows on bats. And further molecular and genetic analysis has showed that it's very likely that the fungus we have was accidentally introduced from Europe. The bats in Europe have evolved with the fungus, and it doesn't seem to cause mass mortality or very little mortality at all in Europe. But you know, our bats were naive, so like a lot of introduced species that wind up in a place they haven't been before, they cause mass devastation, and that's what's happened.
Why should we care? How does the loss of bats affect the ecosystem?
Bats are really incredible little creatures, and you have to realize, you know, the bats we have are tiny. I mean, that our bats weigh, you know, under an ounce, even the bigger ones. Some of them just an eighth of an ounce. But the function they have, I mean, a bat can eat its weight in insects in a night, and all of our bats are insectivorous. And a lot of those insects are crop pests, forest pests. For instance, you know, one of the favorite foods of little brown bats is the mosquito. And we know mosquitoes carry infectious diseases. So we don't really know how this is going to affect our ecosystem, but there was a research paper that was put out, published in Science, that suggested that the agricultural losses alone, if this disease continues to spread across the United States, which it has, is estimated at $23 billion per year to the agricultural industry. Just in the loss of, you know, the insecticide services, you could say, of the bats.
What can people do to support the bat population?
What we're trying to do is we're trying not to spread the disease any faster than it's already spreading by itself through, you know, bat transmission. So we're decontaminating all of our gear. Anybody that goes in caves or hibernacula should decontaminate all their gear when they come out to not spread it to a new place. You know, we can take care of bats, and we can provide homes for them in the form of bat boxes. We can manage our forests to be better places for bats. Plant trees along riparian zones. Allow for large woody snags to remain standing in forests. These are great, you know, summer roost sites for bats. And try not to disturb bats, and that includes both winter and summertime. You know, particularly in the winter when they're hibernating, because this fungus, one of the ways it impacts bats is it causes irritation and actually damage to the skin, and it wakes the bat up out of its sleep. And when it does that, the bat burns up all of its fat stores, and then it starves to death. And that's why they were flying out of the caves in the middle of winter. You know, we really have to reserve any visitation to these hibernacula for research only at this time to minimize waking them up any more than is necessary.
What is a bat box?
There's lots of different forms. I actually have one at my home. It's called a rocket box, and it's a cylindrical piece of PVC pipe that has wooden slats inserted up inside of it. The bottom's open, and the bats actually roost in there in the daytime. And it actually was a maternity roost where they actually have their young. And it just provides a place for them to safely be and spend the days between the nights when they're out foraging. That kind of function used to be served by large hollow trees on landscape, and you know, some forests are maybe managed a little too intensively that we don't have that on the landscape as frequently as we used to. So if we can provide it, that's so much the better.
Nature.org recently reported that there's new research that gives you hope. What is that?
Researchers found that UV light can kill the fungus. So, you know, we know of some other chemicals and such that kill the fungus, but we have to be really careful in the application of these things, especially in hibernacula, because as I stated earlier, there's lots of other types of life in these caves, and some of it's really rare, so rare that some species are only found in a single cave. So we want to protect the bats and allow them to survive and kill the fungus if we can, while not harming any of the other biota. You know, there's all these different techniques that have been developed that are still in the experimental stage, such as the UV light, a vaccine, different atmospheric alteration, like maybe having warmer spots within the hibernacula that the fungus won't grow as well. There is a lot of great research out there that hopefully will prove to be worthy. And, you know, and just maybe some of these bats will be resistant. We do have bats that have survived multiple years in infected hibernacula. Maybe there's some natural resistance that when they reproduce, that'll be passed on to future generations.
I appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Daniel Feller, an ecologist with the Wildlife and Heritage Service of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. At the On the Record page, we'll link to more information about white nose syndrome. Short break now, and when we come back, chatty bats. Beyond echolocation, what do bats have to say? I'm Sheila Kent. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about bats. The furry flying mammals that camp out in caves and traverse the night sky using echolocation. Earlier, we spoke with an ecologist studying white nose syndrome, a disease decimating North America's bat population. Now we turn to Dr. Kirsten Bone, an assistant research professor and lecturer at Johns Hopkins University in the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department. Her research is conducted at the Bat Communication Lab. Dr. Bone, welcome to On the Record.
Hi.
Bats are one of the few animals that rely on echolocation to navigate, but bats make other sounds, too. What are the differences between the sounds they make for echolocation versus the sounds they make to communicate with each other?
Well, I would say the first and foremost is that echolocation is essentially how they see, whereas communication signals serve a completely different purpose. They are to communicate with other animals, other conspecifics, that is, others from their species. So the content and the information is going to be totally different. So they might be communicating, I'm Joe, versus echolocation is essentially a sonar beeping that they use to actually see their environment.
It never sounds like communication to a bat.
They can use them, but we call it more like eavesdropping because the sonar signals are designed over time, or evolution has led to them being very good at extracting information from the environment. So they are specialized for that purpose. And that doesn't leave a lot of leeway for adding other types of information to the signal. Communication sounds, on the other hand, have evolved specifically to communicate information. So they often have a very different structure or sound than those sonar calls.
What are they trying to communicate?
Oh, well, they can communicate all sorts of things. Baby bats have calls that say, I'm Joe, I'm your pup, feed me, I'm hungry. Bats use social communication calls to coordinate foraging and go out foraging, cooperating. Some of the most elaborate and I think most beautiful sounds are their songs. So there are some species of bats that use males produce songs during the mating season, I say, to attract the ladies. So those songs say something like, you know, I'm Ben, I'm really awesome, come mate with me.
Let's take a listen to a couple recordings. Tell us about that recording.
That's actually Ben. He's a Brazilian free-tailed bat, or we also call them Mexican free-tailed bats. And they are one of the most abundant species in the United States. Predominantly in the southern regions, they're very famous. They're the bats that live under the bridge in Austin. And they're actually working their way northward. So I'm actually hoping I might start recording them in Maryland. But what Ben is doing is he is in front of his territory, which is a little roosting site. And he's flapping his wings. And he's trying to attract females to his roost site. He often defends this territory, and the girls females go around listening to the various males, and whatever one is the sexiest, right, whatever sexy is for a bat, she will go and stay in his territory.
And the call is how the female makes that choice?
Exactly, yes.
Normally, my human ears would not be able to hear that.
That's correct. So the song is slowed down 8 times. And so
it's lower so we can hear it.
It's lower so we can hear it. And that's the same with sonar. So we didn't really realize how much vocal communication bats are doing because it was so difficult to record them for so long. Technology in the last 5 to 10 years has just blown up with the ability to record these. So we're finding that all sorts of bats make all sorts of sounds that are for communication.
Let's listen to another one. Very staccato. What's that about?
So that one had a couple of things going on. The beginning, when you just hear a tick, 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 that is the echolocation pulses. They're very short, and then there's a gap. And during that gap after them is when they get the returning echo, which they use to see, and they need to get that returning echo before they produce another one. That's one example of how a signal for sonar is constrained. It can't be really long because then you're still vocalizing while you're getting your echo. There were then some longer, kind of squabbly sounding calls. Those were communication signals. So this recording was from Patapsco State Park, and these were a bunch of bats flying around feeding, and we're not quite sure what they are, you know, saying to each other. That's something we're still trying to figure out.
That's Dr. Kirsten Bone, an assistant research professor and lecturer in the Bat Communication Lab at Johns Hopkins University. So do they ever just gossip?
Wouldn't we love to find out? You know, that's a great question. One way to think of it is, how do we decode it? Like, how do we figure out what all of these signals are communicating?
You know,
what
do
they're
you?
Actually doing? We have to glean what they mean by the behaviors of the animals before and after and the context in which they're produced. We can do some quantitative models of the potential information that's available, which we also do. But it's like translating a language without a, you know, even though we don't want to say bats talk like humans, but we're kind of translating sounds without a dictionary.
Are they really blind as a bat?
No. Bats actually can see pretty well. I would say this, not very many animals see really well at night, and bats are included in that. And imagine being a little tiny animal traveling up to 25 miles per hour, relying on vision without any light would not be a very smart, very, very good way to go. So bats, yes, they all have eyes. They can see. All of the bats in North America use extensive echolocation. There are some bats in, for example, Southeast Asia that don't use echolocation. They're the really cute, big, fuzzy ones with big eyes. Those guys are active during the day and don't use echolocation. They use their vision.
What's the next thing you want to learn in your research?
I feel that my field is just kind of constant discovery right now, because even though bats are a quarter of all mammals, when it comes to communication, we know very little about them because of this ultrasonic, you know, problem. So one, it's just constant discovery. Who knows what I'm going to, you know, when I go out with my microphones, I never know what I'm going to record. It's always a surprise. The other thing I'm looking at is I looked extensively at songs in these Brazilian free-tail bats. There are hundreds of other species in the family. So I'm looking at songs in other species to see how these complex vocalizations evolved. Ultimately, the idea is that this might be a beneficial model for even examining human speech, because there aren't very many mammals, except for, you know, we think of dolphins and cetacean, you know, whales that have these really elaborate vocalizations. Well, I argue that for a mammal, bats are number two. So they may prove to be a good model for understanding how language evolved, how speech evolved, even potentially play a role in therapies.
Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Kirsten Bone is an assistant research professor and lecturer at Johns Hopkins University in the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department. Her research is conducted at the Bat Communication Lab. Dr. Bone will be talking more about the habits of bats at Bat Night at Patapsco State Valley Park, 2 weeks from Saturday on April 21st. Check the On the Record page at WYPR.org for a link to that event. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
For listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!